Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the December 22nd edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is Becoming a Centarian by Calvin Tompkins. Journals, Becoming a Centarian. Like the New Yorker, I was born in 1925. Somewhat to my surprise, I decided to keep a journal of my 100th year. By Calvin Tompkins, December 15, 2025. Old age is no joke, but it can feel like one. You look everywhere for your glasses until your wife points out that you're wearing them. I turn 100 this year. People act as though this is an achievement, and I suppose it is, sort of. Nobody in my family has lived this long, and I've been lucky. I'm still in pretty good health, no wasting diseases or Alzheimer's, and friends and strangers comment on how young I look, which cues me to cite the three ages of man: youth, maturity, and you look great. On the other hand, I've lost so many useful abilities that my wife, Dodie, and I have taken to calling me Feeble Man. Look up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, no, it's Feeble Man. Dodie doesn't want me to know how old she is, but she's nearly 3 decades younger than I am, and I become more dependent on her every day. If I make it to 100, my birthday is December 17th, I'll be what is called a centenarian. More and more people are breaking the two-digit ceiling these days, prompting talk in medical circles about much longer lifespans. I believe the record so far is held by Jean Calment, a French woman who was born in 1875 and died in 1997 at 122, although there is some debate about the validity of her age. When Calment was 90, a widow with no heirs, she sold her apartment in Arles to a local notaire with the written agreement that she could continue to live there by herself until she died, and he would pay the taxes and give her a monthly stipend of 2,500 francs. Calment was still going strong when the notaire died in 1995, and his children paid the taxes and the stipend until her death 2 years later. As Calment put it, in life, one sometimes makes bad deals. Somewhat to my surprise, I decided to keep a journal of my 100th year. I started journals before at various points in my life, but the urge never lasted more than a few months. This time I have a motive. Since 1958, I have been writing for The New Yorker, which, like me, was born in 1925. It recently became clear that interviewing dozens of people, gathering mountains of material, and keeping it all in my head has become increasingly difficult, what with my porous memory and failing eyesight. So why not just accept the inevitable and enjoy a year or two of leisure? I've tried that, and no thanks. Boredom in excelsis. Hence the journal. Not every day, but when an event, experience, person, or thought catches my attention enough to overcome my laziness. February 15th. I'm starting a month and a half in because the journal idea didn't come to me until yesterday. January was a preview of the next 4 years, which may well end up being the worst in American history. Donald Trump trumpeted his second coming with an avalanche of executive orders that sowed chaos and prepared the way for a government of, by, and for the billionaires. His choices for the cabinet and other top positions have been comic or insulting or both. Trump put Elon Musk, the world's richest man, in charge of the brand new Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE. Thousands of government employees have already been fired, and many more will join them. I'm not going to spend much energy groaning about Trumpery in these pages. Plenty of capable people do that every day, and I don't have the time. February 19th. What we've learned in the past weeks is that yes, we can carry on with our lives during the Trump catastrophe. Hours go by, sometimes whole days, when his gloating presence doesn't enter my mind. Maybe I'll forget his name, as I'm constantly doing with friends, family members, and everybody else, living or dead, not permanently, but again and again. This began a few years ago. I forget names all the time. Sometimes when I'm in the middle of talking to or about a person, their name will suddenly go elsewhere. It's embarrassing, but at 99, what isn't? I recently revisited a journal that I kept for a while in 2011 and 2012 and came across this entry. Last week on the Madison Avenue bus, a woman stood up and offered me her seat. I thought she was getting off, but she didn't. It startled me. Still so few indications of age as I turn 86. I didn't really start to feel old until a couple of years ago. And even now, there are periods when the aches and pains seem to vanish. The yoga-based stretching exercises I do twice a day seem to have kept sciatica and other miseries at bay. I hate the short-term memory losses and the increasing unsteadiness with which I totter through the world, but I'm still a long way from what Keats described as being half in love with easeful death. February 21st. Twice in the past week, someone told me I should get a dog. Is this a coincidence or a signal? Dodie and I both had dogs before we married, but not since. Talking about it experimentally last night, Dodie said the only kind she would consider is an Italian greyhound. She likes her animals to be thin. For me, it would be a black Labrador retriever. When I was growing up in West Orange, New Jersey, we had a series of black labs, and the most memorable of them was Loki, named for the Norse god of mischief. Loki's exuberance led him to run away, which he did fairly often. We'd get a call from somebody, our telephone number was attached to his collar, and my father would go out in the car and pick him up. He once had a dream about this. In the dream, Loki came back on his own from a 3-day adventure, and my father said to him very sternly, "Loki, where have you been?" Loki said, "I've been to Montclair." My father loved dogs, and so did I. Before the labs, we had two collies, an English setter, a French bulldog, a Boston bull, and a raccoon named Pete, whom Dad brought back from a fishing trip in the Adirondacks. A forest ranger there had found three starving raccoon cubs with no mother. He offered them for adoption to everyone he met, and Dad took one. Pete stayed with us for 2 years, living with the collies in their indoor kennel and going on bike rides with my older brother Frederick and me. We'd take turns letting him ride on our shoulders. Our mother never got used to Pete, and when he nipped one of her friends at an outdoor tea party, his welcome expired. Dad put him in the car, drove for 2 hours, and released him in the Catskills. 2 days later, he was back. Dad then chauffeured him to the Adirondacks. This time, he didn't return. When I was very young, our grandmother gave us two Persian cats. My mother disliked cats, and she wouldn't let them in the house. They lived in the kennel with the collies and Pete. I once wrote a children's book about an overly friendly mixed-breed dog named Ralph and a haughty Siamese cat named Lavinia, who lived in a house with two children and their parents. Ralph is determined to teach Lavinia how to laugh. Cats, as you may know, have no sense of humor. And in the end, he succeeds. The last scene has Ralph demolishing a dinner party by skidding around on the just-polished wood floor, upsetting tables and scattering drinks. And when it's over and Ralph has been banished to the basement, Lavinia is discovered under a chair, lying on her back and shaking with silent laughter. February 22nd, yesterday's entry reminded me of something that Trippy, my firstborn child, said when she was 3 years old. Her name is Anne. Trippy came from our love of car trips. Our dog then, a brown and black dachshund named Waldy, had stopped eating and we were taking him to the vet. He was on her lap in the front seat of the car, and I could see she was really worried about him. I said, "Trip, he's going to be fine. You know how, when you get sick, we take you to the doctor and he gives you something that makes you well. It's just like that." Trippy was quiet for a while, and then she said, in the sweetly thoughtful voice that still delights me today, "Dad, is Waldy's doctor a dog?" February 26th. The New Yorker celebrated its 100th birthday last night with a party for 400 people at a club downtown. The magazine's first issue came out on February 21st, 1925, 10 months before I did. Dodie and I rarely go to big, deafening social events, but we went to this one. David Remnick, the magazine's editor, met us at the entrance with enveloping hugs that made us feel he was touched by our being there. We stayed for half an hour, saw Bruce Dionne, Chip McGrath, Calvin Bud Trillin, Cressida Lachon, my editor, and lots of other friends whose names skittered away from me. On the way out, we bucked an incoming tide of celebrants who were just arriving. The New Yorker, which started out as what Harold Ross, its founding editor, called a comic weekly, has held and still holds a unique place in this country's cultural history. We subscribed to The New Yorker when I was growing up, and I probably began looking at the cartoons when I was 9 or 10. My father read every issue. He sometimes complained that the articles were too long. I remember him saying he'd get to the end of a very long piece, only to find that it was the first of 5 parts. By the time I joined the staff in 1960, after 3 years of writing for Newsweek and contributing short humor pieces called casuals to The New Yorker, the long fact pieces were, at least sometimes, getting shorter, 10 to 12,000 words instead of 15 or 20,000. My first profile in 1962 was about a Swiss artist named Jean Tingley, who made large sculpture machines with moving parts. I had been fascinated by his homage to New York from 1960, which included bicycle wheels, small motors, radios, a piano, automobile parts, a huge balloon that inflated and then burst, and many other elements from the junkyard. The sole purpose of this ridiculous monolith, which it largely achieved, was to destroy itself in the garden of the Museum of Modern Art. I knew very little about art then, and Tingley's irreverent approach, which made ample room for humor, set me on a course of writing mainly, but not exclusively, about contemporary art and artists. March 8th, Juan Hamilton, who attached himself to Georgia O'Keeffe when he was 27 and she was 85, died last month at his home in Santa Fe. He had started working for O'Keeffe in 1973, a week before I went out to New Mexico to spend a few days interviewing her. After lunch one day, O'Keeffe asked Hamilton to drive us in her Volkswagen minibus from her house at Ghost Ranch, north of Santa Fe, to the Monastery of Christ in the desert so she could see the purple asters in bloom there. I have a vivid memory of O'Keeffe in a long white dress, bouncing around imperturbably in the back seat as Hamilton navigated the barely visible dirt roads. She talked amicably with the Benedictine monks at the monastery while we were there, and on the way back she said it would be very easy for her to convert someone to Catholicism. "It has great appeal," she said. "Not for me, of course, but I can see the appeal." There was a lot of speculation about O'Keeffe's relationship with Hamilton, but to me it seemed easy and natural. He was with her until she died in 1986, and his gentle, joking presence certainly made her last years more pleasant. She left him most of the paintings that had not been promised elsewhere, and that led to bitter lawsuits and accusations of undue influence. But Hamilton and O'Keeffe's relatives agreed to a settlement in the end. Another memory. The three of us, O'Keeffe, Hamilton, and I, are in the kitchen and she is cooking dinner, a chicken and 5 different kinds of squash from her garden. It's her regular cook's night off. Something is wrong with the stove. O'Keeffe kneels down and peers into the gas oven, and suddenly there's a flash and a loud explosion. O'Keeffe stands up shakily. Both her eyelids are scorched. "Well, it seems we're not having chicken," she says. Juan and I exchange astonished glances, but nobody says another word. My profile of O'Keeffe was published in the March 4th, 1974 issue, and a month later she wrote me a letter. She had something to ask me, she said. Would I come back to New Mexico so she could ask it in person? Of course, I said yes. There was no monograph on her work at that time, and I assumed she would ask me to write one. I was wrong. What she wanted was for me to look at notes she had been writing about her paintings. O'Keeffe had decided to publish them, but her younger sister Claudia had told her they were ungrammatical and should not be published. The notes were vintage O'Keeffe, brief, vivid, enlightening, and yes, often ungrammatical, but brilliantly so. I told her they should absolutely be published. She asked me how to go about that. I offered to call my agent, and she said, yes, please do. I made the call from her living room. Don Congdon, my agent at the time, could barely contain his excitement. Within a week, he had negotiated a contract with the Viking Press, and Georgia O'Keeffe, the first illustrated book on her work, came out in 1976 and became a bestseller. So much for good grammar. March 12th. These notes tend to deal with the past. Here's one in the present. This morning, when I was brushing my teeth, I saw one of those furry, long-legged insects heading toward me on the bathroom floor. I raised a leg and tried to step on it, but missed. The bug veered off in another direction, and I followed it, stamping and missing until I lost my balance and fell heavily. Nothing was broken, but I felt humiliated, defeated by a helpless creature who wished me no harm, and that made me laugh. Maybe I'll write a series of stories about Feebleman and Millie the Millipede, a book, and call it The Adventure of Feebleman. March 13th. Yesterday morning, Dodie and I went to the Metropolitan Museum to see the exhibition of work by Caspar David Friedrich, whose uncanny ability to paint atmospheric landscapes with or without figures in them makes you feel you are there. Until 6 months ago, I could walk the 10 blocks from our apartment to the museum, but now we go by Uber, and I view the art from a wheelchair. Unhappily, I have found that looking at pictures from a wheelchair, with your eyes about 2 feet below where you would be if you were standing, has irreparable defects, in this case, reflections of the gallery's overhead lights, which blotted out the paintings. I could remedy the problem by standing up, but that required pushing away the wheelchair's footrests, and it made me feel so unsteady that I tried it only twice. I sometimes think my main complaint about old age is the way it interferes with looking at art and listening to music. Although the remote control for my hearing aids has a setting for music, it never really works. All music sounds so off-key to my ears that it's just noise. An audiologist once admitted to me that hearing aids and music are not friends. March 16th. When we invite people to dinner at our apartment, we ask them to come at 7 and all but suggest that they leave by 9. One of us will joke that this is the time I start to drool, but the real reason is that from 9 on I can no longer take part in a conversation. It happens to me quite suddenly. I just drop out and sit there smiling like an imbecile. The drooling comes later when I'm asleep. I wake up and find that one side of the pillow is soaking wet. Old age is so embarrassing. Years ago, Michael Sonnabend, a Dante scholar who married the art dealer Elania Castelli, whose first husband was the legendary Leo Castelli, when they were both well along in years, made me laugh by saying, as he left a party, that he had to go home and change his diaper. Now the adult version comes in packets of 40, and I use 3 a day. March 29th. Much attention these days is paid to the benefits and the dangers of artificial intelligence, AI, but hardly any is paid to what I call artificial stupidity, AS. Donald Trump has made remarkably effective use of AS. Even Trump can't possibly believe that he can make Canada our 51st state. The whole idea is too absurd to take seriously, but Trump's repeated references to it add to the chaos and uncertainty that shroud his more sordid activities, such as attacks on the rule of law. Artificial stupidity means deciding to believe something that has no basis in fact, logic, or common sense. When I started using the phrase a year ago, it was sort of a joke, but the breakdown of trust in our government and our social institutions, which paved the way to Trump's second term, has made it all too serious. April 6th, it seems that I am legally blind. This comes as a surprise. Last year, Merck Heinemann, our longtime ophthalmologist and friend, showed me on my annual visit a photograph that revealed some macular degeneration in my right eye. With luck, it might not get any bigger, he said, and he prescribed a stronger lens for the other eye. I've always felt that my eyes were functioning more or less normally, given their age. Much of the time, I don't wear my distance glasses. The world is a little blurry, but I don't bump into things. Since the pandemic, Dodie and I have been spending more time at our place in Rhode Island. I went to the local eye clinic there a while ago because I was having trouble reading small print, and the optometrist I saw must have passed the results on to the Rhode Island Department of Human Services. At any rate, a very pleasant young woman came to the house to break the news that I was legally blind and that the town we live in had amenities to offer, including a tax break. Here's what I got without even asking. One, a red and white walking stick, whose colors are the international signal for a legally blind and deaf person. Two, a cube clock with a large yellow button that, when pressed, elicits a slightly impatient male voice announcing the time. Another button activates an alarm, which can be the sound of a bell, a horn, a cuckoo, a beeping, or a two-tone chime. Three, a talking book reader with someone reading aloud. This one is the property of the U.S. government and must be returned if I don't want to use it or die or something. Four, 12 Pilot Bravo bold point marker pens. Five, a talking alarm clock that you wear on a chain around your neck. Six, three copies of a letter certifying that I am permanently legally blind to be used when applying for a handicap parking certificate or a tax adjustment. It was all somewhat overwhelming. So far, I've put away the cane, which was heavier than the one I'd been using, and tried writing with a bold point marker pen, which left a smudge on my index finger that I'm still trying to scrub off. I plan to look into the tax break. I did, and I didn't qualify. The rest of my booty lies in a corner, untouched. New stuff is daunting to old guys, especially when the instructions are in small print. April 7th. In my long life, I can't say as Edith Piaf does, in one day of her defiant chansons, that I have no regrets. Most of mine center on my four children, whom I put through my three divorces in several periods when they had less fathering than they deserved. They all made it to adulthood, marriage, children of their own, and interesting careers, and when we see each other now, it's pure pleasure. Trippie, Susan, and Spencer, the three kids from my first marriage, love to reminisce about the annual ski trips we took during spring break to Sugarbush, Stratton, Stowe, and other Vermont mountains, trips that we all remember as among the happiest times in our lives. Sarah, from my third marriage, missed out on the skiing, but I probably spent more time with her when she was growing up. I used to take her to Central Park on the back of my bike. One day I stopped to chat with a friend from the New Yorker. I was standing beside the bike, and suddenly it started to fall away from me. I yelled, "Oh shit!" made a frantic lunge and just managed to keep bike and 2-year-old daughter from a bad fall, while Sarah chanted happily, "Oh shit, oh shit, oh shit." My New Yorker friend couldn't stop laughing. Sarah became a lawyer. Trippie taught high school chemistry until 6 years ago, when she retired. Think of that. Susan put together a personal service practice that included cooking, secretarial work, and help with tax returns. Spencer, the only one who lives in New York, is a private art dealer who can earn on a good day more than I can in a year. They all make me feel I'm a splendid father, and I enjoy believing them. Years ago, on one of our ski trips, we decided to take a lesson together. Trippie and Spencer were assigned to a more advanced group than Susan and I. The two of us stayed close for an hour, practicing our turns and laughing at our falls and near falls. And toward the end of the lesson, the instructor, a young woman who was not much older than Susan, said, "What's the relationship between you two?" Sue said, with a quiet pride that I'll never forget, "He's my dad." In my book, the good luck far outweighs the regrets. April 16th. Most nights, Dodie and I have dinner at home. We used to go to Art World dinner parties and to restaurants we liked, but my hearing ability now vanishes if people around me are talking, so we tend to stay home. Neither of us really knows how to cook. The menu is limited. Rotisserie chicken from Fresh Direct, salads of all kinds, broiled salmon, linguine with my pesto sauce, omelets. That's pretty much it. Dodie makes the salads, which can include three or four ingredients, different lettuces, plus arugula, kale, and spinach, and I do the omelets. I wish I could say I learned how to make an omelet from Julia Child, whom I profiled in 1974, but I actually learned much earlier when my first wife and I spent a weekend with an uncle of mine, who decreed that each of us would make a different dish for dinner, and I made omelets using a recipe in his copy of Joy of Cooking. 2 decades later, I watched Julia on TV making an omelet on an electric hot plate, nursing it to fold over just by manipulating the pan as she talked. On the spot, I joined the millions of people whom she had already bewitched. She was so warm and so funny. There was a time when some viewers complained about her using wine in her recipes, and Julia liked to tease them. "Now I'll add a half teaspoon of white wine," she would say in her plummy voice as she poured copiously from the bottle. "The children will love it." April 24th, breakfast at our New York apartment with Gavin Brown, an artist in dealer's clothing. He had a broken foot and hobbled in on crutches. I had misheard Dodie, as I often do these days, and thought we were expecting the artist, Cy Gavin. Gavin Brown has always been a uniquely contrary, anti-mainstream figure on the New York art scene. A British-born artist who became a dealer here and introduced Elizabeth Payton, Rikrit Tirvanji, Peter Doig, Chris Ofili, Urs Fischer, and other young artists, most of whom eventually left his gallery for others that could offer them more money. He also reintroduced Alex Katz. Brown is still an irreverent and unpredictable presence. We talked about art, which he said has come to a halt and gone somewhere else. And then he asked how I would feel about his optioning Off the Wall, my 1980 book on Robert Rauschenberg, as the basis of a feature film. Rauschenberg was the ultimate romantic, the embracer of mistakes, he said. It would be about how you would get the spirit, the mystery of art making into film. I think it would be a great romantic story. Gavin has never made a feature film. What he meant was that he would somehow find the money and put together a production team. We discussed this for a while and agreed, amid much laughter, that his people would call my people. I tried to find out how he had broken his foot, but got nowhere. "There are four screws in it," he said. April 29th. Paula Cooper was honored last night at the New Museum's gala dinner, which drew about 600 art worlders to Cipriani South Street, a huge place that is as far downtown as a restaurant can get. She had a bad cold, and she looked fragile, but also beautiful and wise. Her gallery was the first to open downtown in 1968 in what was already being called Soho, and the minimalist and conceptual artists she showed, many of whom she still shows, were the ones that other artists admired. Hans Hoch, Mark DeServo, Elizabeth Murray, Robert Gober, Rudolf Stengel, Jennifer Bartlett, Bernd and Hillel Becker, Christian Markley, Carl Andre, Dan Flevin, Sol LeWitt, Donald Judd, and Robert Ryman, among many others. I can't remember when I first met Paula, but it must have been in the early 70s. Some years later, we found ourselves staying at the same hotel on the left bank, the Mont Lambert. We had dinner together there one night, and afterward, when we got into the elevator, I felt as though something was going to happen, but it didn't. We exchanged strangely awkward good nights when she got off on her floor and I continued on to mine. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine, on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Ternan. What Paula remembers of the evening is that it was one of the few times I saw him when he was alone. He always had a woman guarding him. About 10 years after this, I introduced her to Jack McRae, my publisher and my closest friend. His long marriage had been broken up. Paula had been single for ages, and it struck me that they would like each other. It was my only try at matchmaking, and a complete success. They left together that night, got married a year later, and lived together very happily until Jack's death, 2 years ago. May 5th. The New Yorker has been devoting more attention to its centennial year than I have to mine. Every issue dusts off a gem from the past. In the latest issue, Anthony Lane gives us a witty rundown on 12 books that various staffers have written on life at the magazine, including James Thurber's The Years with Ross from 1957 and Gardner Botsford's A Life of Privilege Mostly from 2003. Lane, who reviewed movies for the magazine between 1993 and 2024, was the only New Yorker writer in that role who consistently made me laugh, and he does so frequently here. The entire stack could be crowned with the heading, Fanfare for the Comma Men, he writes. His piece also let me wonder why, in all my years at the magazine, I never wrote about it. The answer, I think, is that I've never been fully there. When I came on staff, there were no empty offices, so I worked at home. Eventually, I got an office, but I kept on working at home. I came in only when a piece of mine was closing, to work with the editor and the fact checker. That way I got to know several editors and fact-checkers quite well, but not many writers, and I didn't become part of the everyday life of the place. I felt more at home in the art world, which would become the main focus of my work. In my early years at The New Yorker, the editor was William Shawn, who had succeeded Harold Ross in 1952. Once a year, Shawn would knock on the door of my office. He had ways of knowing when I was there, and with my new contract in hand. He would apologize for disturbing me. Sean was unshakably formal and quite shy. I would sign the document on the spot, not even pretending to glance at it, and he would say, "Thank you, Mr. Tompkins," and leave. When I had a new piece to submit, I would send it via office mail to Sean and wait. Usually I'd hear nothing for several days, but sometimes the wait was longer. On one occasion, after waiting for nearly 3 weeks, the suspense was so agonizing that I called him on the phone. "Oh, Mr. Tompkins, I've been trying to reach you," he said untruthfully. Nothing was wrong. He liked the piece. So why the delay? In spite of such mysteries, I felt and still feel that writing for The New Yorker is the best thing I could have done. I've had many editors. Each of them has improved my prose and my thinking. And the fact-checkers have saved me from any number of embarrassing mistakes. Sean edited quite a few writers himself, and I've heard two of them say it was a great experience, but he never edited me. The only New Yorker person I saw regularly outside the office was Roger Angel, a senior fiction editor for many years. In the 1950s, he and I both lived in Schnedden's Landing, a small community on the Hudson River south of Nyack, and our children were roughly the same age. I was writing for Newsweek then. Roger urged me to try writing casuals for The New Yorker, and when I did, he edited the ones that were accepted. About half of them were not. His rejections could be biting. Roger did not believe in softening blows. In addition to being the smartest person in any room, he was highly competitive, and sometimes I felt that he enjoyed rejecting things. A number of staffers found him insufferable. "People write me off all the time," he once said to me, with the implications that it didn't seem to bother him a bit. It seemed a little unfair that this powerful editor and scion of the New Yorker royalty, his mother, Catherine White, helped Harold Ross shape the magazine and served as its first fiction editor, was also a marvelous writer whose pieces on baseball, published in the magazine and collected in several books, are great reading for lifelong baseball fans and for people who have never even been to a game. Longer ago than I like to think, Roger and I and our wives went on a ski trip to Vermont. On the last day, as the sun was setting, the two of us decided to take one more run down the mountain. The wives had already gone back to the lodge. I finished before he did, and as we agreed, waited for him so we could ski to the lodge together. The wind had subsided, and there were long shadows on the snow. I noticed that the lift was still running with nobody on it, and I couldn't resist. I hustled over and got on the chair, and as it rose high above the hill, I saw Roger below me. I waved and shouted, making motions urging him to get on the lift. But when he saw me, he threw down his poles and with both arms consigned me to outer darkness. I didn't see him again until that evening when the four of us met at the lodge's dining room. There was no mention of what had happened, but as we studied the menus, Roger said reflectively, "I looked at myself in the mirror just now when I was shaving, and I said, 'Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the most ill-tempered of us all?' We all laughed, including the girls who was taking our orders. Friendship with Roger was complicated, but almost always worth the effort. He had brought me to the New Yorker after all, and we stayed friends at a slight distance until he died 3 years ago when he was 101. May 18th. We have moved back to our Rhode Island place in what we call Newport, but is really Middletown, one town over. Dodie grew up in Newport, where her family, the Kazgians, had established an import business in 1882. Once an active port city, Newport is now a tourist haven for people who come to see the palatial summer homes of the Astors, Vanderbilts, Westmores, and other grandees of the Gilded Age. Many of those families brought their Chinese porcelains and other statue building art objects from the John H. Kazanjian and Company store on Bellevue Avenue. One of my own ancestors, whom I was named after, had a brief association with the Cornelius Vanderbilt. Calvin Tompkins, my great-great-grandfather, ran barges up and down the Hudson River in the 1830s when Vanderbilt steamboats were ferrying passengers around the New York area. One day, so the story goes, Vanderbilt urged him to invest in railroads, as he was doing, and the great-great-grandfather Tompkins, in his wisdom, declined. "There's no money in railroads," he said. "I'm sticking to the river." Newport has so many attractions, one of which is the wound center at Newport Hospital. I'd had a rather bad fall that tore up the skin on the back of one leg. At my age, weak skin and blood-thinning drugs make me vulnerable to this kind of thing. Dodie's bandaging hadn't stopped the bleeding, so she called the hospital and was told to bring me to the emergency room. Hoping to avoid that, Dodie said that what I had was really just a scrape, a wound, and the person she was talking to said, "Oh, a wound, then bring him to the wound center." Apparently, this is the hospital's best-kept secret. Half an hour later, I was in the reclining chair, and a Dr. Rocco and Joe Fullinot, one of his assistants, were dressing my wound. What does the well-dressed wound wear these days? After a thorough cleansing, Joe applied a layer of white zinc cream and then wrapped my leg from foot to knee in layers of adhesive bandage cloth, all without causing me the slightest pain. Dodie and I came back twice a week for the rebandaging, and then, 2 months after the wound had healed, we did it all again after I leaned into a stone step and gashed my left shin. When the bandage came off this one, Dr. Rocco and his crew of assistants gathered to give us a friendly farewell and a blue elastic bracelet with Wound Care Alumni on it. I look forward with pleasure to my next injury. May 21st. I can no longer read books, magazines, or newspapers. This happened quite suddenly. About a week ago, I found myself struggling so hard to read an essay in the New York Review of Books that I stopped trying. There had been warnings, I'll admit, but until that moment, it had not occurred to me that something so essential could just go away. Dodie has made an appointment for next week with Dr. Collins, the Newport ophthalmologist, and we'll see what else, if anything, can be done. May 24th. Paul Moakley, who runs the New Yorker's film and video department, wants to make a short documentary about me. I knew only vaguely that the magazine had such a department. It seems that it is more than 10 years old, and one of its short films won an Academy Award in March. My first impulse was to say no because I'm so bad at remembering names, but Moakley was easy to talk to, and he had read a lot of my pieces in the magazine. And Doty said, "Of course you'll do it. The first interview or session or whatever it turns into has been set for August." May 26th. Since we started reading the Times online 5 years ago, the paper has lost some of its implacable authority. Dodie reads the headlines to me at breakfast. We decide which stories we want to hear, and she reads them aloud. At lunch, we return to fiction. Jane Austen, Vladimir Nabokov, Ian McEwan. The one feature we never skip is Maureen Dowd's opinion column. In Trump's Moral Universe, she wrote on May 24th, "The right thing to do is always the thing that makes him richer." May 28th. Today is Dodie's and my anniversary. We've been married for 37 years. My son Spencer informed us via email that if the marriage lasts 3 more years, it will be longer than the three others combined. May 29th. Dr. Collins had no good news for me. I now have macular degeneration in both eyes. The recent sharp decline in my ability to read was expectable, he says, and stronger eyeglass lenses will not help. All this would have been pretty crushing if I had not been visited a week earlier by Molly Farber, another Samaritan from the League of the Legally Blind. Molly brought along a bag of useful devices, including plastic measuring cups and spoons with the amounts written on them in large white letters, all kinds of protective gloves to prevent burns and cuts in the kitchen, and best of all, a compact, uncomplicated magnifying device that sits on the page of a book or a magazine and makes every word readable. I liked it so much that I end up buying one. June 2nd. What time is it? Dodie murmured as I came back to bed from the bathroom. 3:45, I said. And for the next half hour, lying in bed, I found myself mouthing the words to Chattanooga Choo Choo. All of them, from "You leave the Pennsylvania station about 3:45" to "Chattanooga Choo Choo, won't you choo choo me home." How on earth did I do that? I can barely remember the names of close friends, and I haven't listened to that song in at least 5 decades. Memory is often absurd this way. I don't even like the song. Or maybe I do. A little. June 8th. Elon Musk's love affair with Donald Trump is over. After leaving the government, Musk suggested that Trump should be impeached. Trump said he was very disappointed with Musk and threatened to cancel his many government contracts. Tune in next week or the week after, or not at all. June 9th. Dodie said she was going to get more music in my life. I said no, my hearing aids are incompatible with music. But then I started to think about it. I always say no, Dodie tells me, and maybe she's right. Have I experimented enough with the music buttons on my remote? I really miss listening to music. Maybe this is why I constantly find myself hearing it in my head, all kinds of music, from Chattanooga Choo Choo to Mozart's overture to the magic flute. I used to listen to that sublime piece over and over again, and when I came to the repeated phase of three ascending notes, I could rarely suppress tears. I was overcome by the joy of it and by the miracle of all those musicians landing with such precision and grace on the right note at the same moment. There must be some way of trying to get that back. I'll keep trying. June 10th. As if in answer to the last line in the above entry, today's Times ran an ad for the Horizon 9, a revolutionary new hearing aid that is smaller than a coffee bean and offering a staggering increase in hearing ability. Dodie was not impressed. She said ads like this appear all the time. She sent it to Sarah Bozziak, our audiologist, who confirmed her doubts. My hearing loss is way beyond any such device. The paraphernalia of old age piles up. Molly Farber, the angel of legal blindness, visited us again last week and left still more devices, including another magnifier to try out. She also had plastic pillboxes for each day of the week and a computer keyboard with keys, about twice as large as the usual ones. And it sits on top of the computer, and when I tried to use it, the computer went wild, spinning off lines and question marks before I could induce it to stop. I think we'll pass on that one. June 11th. Do I think about death? Yes, of course. I think about it fairly often, but without emotion. The question was settled for me years ago when I realized that I don't believe in any sort of afterlife. What I believe is that all of us, humans, animals, birds, plants, trees, and so forth, are part of the same natural world, and that death is as essential as life. This, for me, has always been a calming thought. A great many humans believe in higher beings, single or multiple, and their belief has inspired miracles of thought and art, as well as senseless wars and cruelties. I respect the believers, but I don't envy them. As for my living so long, I am grateful for that and ready to accept death whenever it shows up. June 16. The artists Cy Gavin and Alex DeCourt spent 3 days with us in Rhode Island. Cy is designing an installation at what used to be called the International Yacht Restoration School for Doty's not-for-profit enterprise, Art in Newport, which she started in 2017 to bring international contemporary art and artists to Newport. Cy's new works are rarely like anything he's done before. We had no idea what he would come up with this time, and neither did he. Alex, whose work is conceptual, is developing a series of lecture performances at the Metropolitan Museum on the subject of art and glass. His January lecture is on Duchamp. I am speaking as though I am him in spirit, Alex said. When we discussed it at dinner last night, I realized how little I remember about the large glass, Duchamp's most complex artwork. Its official name is The Bride Stripped Bare by Her Bachelors, even. Duchamp spent years creating it, and then, when sloppy crating caused it to shatter in transit after an appearance at the Brooklyn Museum, he restored it shard by shard and told friends that he liked it better with the cracks. I published a biography of Duchamp in 1996. I'd like to reread it before Alex's lecture, but I can't. Using the new magnifier, it would take me a month or more. Countless books on Duchamp have been published since mine came out, but no biographies in English. This makes me feel I still own the man, even though I've forgotten more about him than most people ever knew. As one of the last Duchampians who actually knew Duchamp, I am often asked by artists and non-artists what he was like. It's a hard question to answer. When Mary Reynolds, whom Duchamp had lived with off and on in the 1930s and 40s, was dying from cancer in 1950, she told her friend Elizabeth Hume that she could no longer stand being with people. "Am I people?" Hume asked, and Mary said, with a rueful laugh, "Yes, even you too. Marcel is the only person I ever met who was not people. He could be in a room with me, and I could still feel alone." It was a strange tribute, one that reflected her respect for the solitude and the absolute freedom that Duchamp needed to do his work. Mary had chosen to live in Paris, and Duchamp had moved to New York and had become an American citizen. When he learned that she was dying, he went to Paris and stayed with her during the last 10 days of her life. June 24th. Yesterday, quite suddenly, my eyesight got even worse. I had been making corrections in the June 16th entry. I got up to go to the bathroom, and when I came back, I could barely see the words on the page or the keys on the computer. What had happened? I lay down on the bed, and with a vague hope that if I closed my eyes for a little while, things would clear up, but they didn't. Shaken, I wondered if I was going really blind, not just legally. But away from the desk, everything seemed normal. I could see the house next to ours in as much detail as usual, and the trees around it and across the river to the houses there. The objects on my desk were blurry, though, and using the computer had become almost impossible. Something had definitely happened that morning, or had it. Reading a book or a magazine was already impossible for me without a magnifier. Why should using the computer be any different? The solution stared me in the face. I would have to start dictating, something I had never considered before. Dodie, when I broached the subject to her, said, "Of course, we'll do it together." She has to do a piece for Vogue first and open the Cy Gavin exhibition, so it will be a while before we can start what, my career as a dictator. July 2nd. I had two very bad days, feeling that my whole world was collapsing at breakneck speed. It wasn't, of course. What's happened is neither sudden nor surprising. Dodie and I discussed this at breakfast. I was raving about how I refused to make her give up 2 hours every morning to take dictation, and how she said nothing would give her more pleasure. What we're doing right now is exploring the process. She's sitting at my desk with me, taking down what I say, deleting it so I can say something better. It's going to be a while before this becomes even marginally doable, but I'm starting to feel a little calmer. So am I, Dodie says. I am exhausted, but it's a start. July 17th. Went to the sessions of sweet silent thought. I summon up remembrances of things past. I sigh the lack of many a thing I sought, and with old woes new wail my dear time's waste. In my junior year of college, I took a course on Shakespeare's sonnets, just the sonnets. The professor condemned us to read all 154 of them, memorize as many as we could, and be tested on what we remembered. That sounded impossible. How could we remember even five of them? To our great surprise, however, almost all of us did fairly well on the first test. And although today I can't quote a single entire sonnet, snatches from several of them, such as the opening lines of Sonnet 30 quoted above, have stayed with me. It fascinates me that these days, with my short-term memory in tatters, I can remember anything at all. What is it about these four lines that makes them stay in my head, and how does that relate to my faultless memory of every word in Chattanooga Choo Choo, which I never tried or wanted to memorize? Vladimir Nabokov's Speak Memory, which Dodie is currently reading aloud to me, takes us deep into such questions. Nabokov's command of words is Shakespearean as he describes the earliest experience he can remember. It occurred in the park of his wealthy family's country estate on an August day in 1903 when he was 4 years old. He was walking with his mother, a 27-year-old being in soft white and pink, and his father, who was dressed in the colorful uniform of the Russian Horse Guard officer, which he had pulled out of storage to amuse the others. Walking between them, he writes, "I see my diminutive self as celebrating the birth of sentient life." We can't all share Nabokov's elevated consciousness of himself and his world, but I like to think there is a link between the excitement of his discovery and my remembering Shakespeare's lines. My memory of them is not infallible. I tend to forget the word sessions in Sonnet 30. I struggle with when to the what, and then out of nowhere, sessions floats down, with the sibilance of its neighbors sweet and silent. Telling this to Dodie, I am for some reason close to tears, and so is she. July 22nd. The last entry was our first sustained attempt at dictation. Dodie put what I came up with into magnified type 300% that I could read, and then I spent the next 4 days moving sentences around, adding new words and deleting others, repunctuating everything, and rethinking what it was that I wanted to say and how to say it. It was hard work, exhausting at times, and I kept going with the aid of brief naps. But all that was not much different from my lifelong writing process. For many years, it had seemed to me that the physical act of typing was essential to the flow of words that came to me in short bursts. But the ideas flowed about as well with Dodie typing. These days, sitting at my desk on the second floor of our Rhode Island cottage, I spent a lot of time looking out the window at the new house next door. It's a modernistic two-story structure with an Olympic-sized swimming pool. The odd thing is that since it was finished a couple of years ago, nobody seems to live there. Once in a while, we see a few young people swimming in the pool or lying on one of the many chaise lounges On rare occasion, always holidays, they stay overnight and leave the next day. But for months at a time, the house is empty. We've never met the owners. We did know and like the people who used to live next door, Dottie and Ed Sheffield. They were friendly and older than we were. Every year, Dottie, who belonged to the Newport Garden Club, gave Dottie ginger plants from her garden to be used as ground cover. And every summer, they gave a dinner party for their many friends. After an hour of cocktails, dinner began with a cup of cold Vichyssoise served while we were still standing. Dottie and Ed stopped coming a few years back. Both of them died soon after. Their son Wynn came occasionally, but in 2022, we heard that he and his brother had sold the house. We were living full-time in Rhode Island then because of the pandemic. In November, we went down to New York for a few days, during which time I had a pacemaker installed. My heartbeat is normal but subject to fibrillations. The day we left, a monstrous demolition vehicle appeared on the lawn next door, and when we came back, the Sheffield's house, Daisy Fields, had vanished without a trace. August 14th. I am flat on my back on the floor of the bathroom. The top of my wooden shaving bowl dropped to the floor, and as I squatted to retrieve it, I heard Dottie call out from the next room, "Don't bend down, I'll pick it up." But I was already bending down and losing my balance. Dottie got there in time to prevent my head from hitting the sink as I fell, but I landed hard on my back and my rump. Falls are the scourge of old age. I've had four or five during the past 2 years, and it was pure luck that kept me from serious injury. Our ENT doctor and dear friend, Vijay Anand, once misjudged the distance between himself and the bed he was sitting down on, and he spent the next year and a half in the intensive care unit of the hospital. At first, I thought I'd been lucky again, but I found that, even with Dottie's help, I was getting unable to get myself up from the floor. She called her brother John, who lives nearby. He came over, and for what seemed like an hour, the three of us struggled to move me over so I could be kneeling. And that's all we have time for today. Calvin Tompkins is a staff writer. His books include The Lives of Artists, a six-volume collection of his New Yorker profiles. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.